The Democracy Paradox podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute has a 40-year history of excellence in advancing research and education on global democracy and human development. Learn more about the Kellogg Institute, including its world-renowned visiting fellowships for scholars at various stages of their careers at kellogg.nd.edu.
In the past 26 years, to this day, there has not been one major Hollywood production that has gone against a major Chinese Communist Party red line. Not one. 26 years of silence. And what's especially astonishing about that is that in 1997, the Chinese economy was like one-tenth the size of the U.S. It was not huge, not the way it is now. But even more shocking is that the Chinese box office was like negligible.
Welcome to the Democracy Paradox podcast. This is my daddy.
My name is Justin Kemp, and I am your host as we explore the democracy paradox. Sometimes it seems as though authoritarian governments like China and Russia have every advantage. They play according to their own rules. Meanwhile, democracies have to take the higher ground. They try to show restraint, and when they don't, they face criticism both at home and abroad. Consequently, it can feel as though democracies have to fight with one hand tied behind their back. Bethany Allen does not believe that this has to be the case. She is the China reporter at Axios and the author of Beijing Rules: How China Weaponized Its Economy to Confront the World. On the surface, this is yet another book about how China abuses its influence throughout the globe, but it's also about how the United States and other liberal democracies can actually fight back. My conversation with Bethany discusses some cases where China has used its economic influence to impose its will on corporations, politicians, and even other countries. But we also discuss some novel ways that the United States and others could respond. We also talk about how views on China have changed in recent years and why that happened. For longtime listeners, you'll find the episode complements some past conversations with Ayn Kokas and Anne Applebaum, among others. First-time listeners, though, will likely find this episode eye-opening. Now, if you like this podcast, please tell your friends and colleagues. Christmas is around the corner, and I personally would love a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Now, I do want to mention that recently, I've been talking to different organizations about sponsoring the podcast. I've been mentioning this over the past few episodes. A few are coming through. This means I will have some ads on the podcast starting very early in 2024. If you want to listen ad-free, I'll have episodes available to monthly donors on Patreon or paid subscribers on Apple Podcasts for $5 per month. If you are a nonprofit organization, a business, or academic institution and would like to sponsor the podcast, send me an email to jkempf@democracyparadox.com. You can also email me with questions or comments about past episodes. But for now, here is my conversation with Bethany Allen. Bethany Allen, welcome to the Democracy Paradox.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Bethany, I loved your book, Beijing Rules: How China Weaponized Its Economy to Confront the World. There's a lot of books out there on China and about how it's kind of rising up in terms of expressing sharp power. That's the way that the National Endowment of Democracy puts it. I thought your book really stood apart from a lot of the others that I've read. I felt that it really brought a lot of ideas together, so I'm very excited to be able to talk to you today. I'd like to kind of start out by asking you a semi-personal question. I mean, it's when did you notice that China was weaponizing its economy internationally? Like, when did it catch your attention, like you yourself?
I think probably starting in 2017 and 2018, maybe even 2016. I can't put a single, you know, moment to that. It wasn't like one particular incident. And the reason was because for a while, how people were thinking about this was that it was extraterritorial censorship. This was the frame that people were kind of initially putting on it, because so many of the prominent examples of it were about shutting down speech. A piece I wrote in, I think it was maybe 2018, maybe 2017, when the Chinese government, for example, required any airlines that, you know, had flights that flew to China, but they used that as a hook to say, you airlines across all of your company everywhere need to make sure that the way that you talk about Taiwan is in line, you know, with our sovereignty claims. And those demands were made to, I think, 18 airlines, if not more, and all of them immediately complied. Many airlines now will just refer to, oh, you're flying to Taipei. They won't say what country it's in. It's just Taipei. Out of time and space, we're flying to Taipei. Who knows where that may be? Anyway, so it was initially viewed as a censorship thing. But what I started to think and to see and to observe was that that was really not doing justice to this kind of power, because there were more and more examples I was seeing of how the Chinese government was using this kind of hook that its economy has, not just to control speech, but also to shape government decision making, to shape the defense policies of countries, to shape and reshape multilateral institutions and foreign policies. So I started to try to think of how to think about this in a comprehensive way. What is the power that we're looking at here? I love the National Endowment for Democracy's term sharp power. They were the first to really come up with a useful term. And I remember specifically right when they released that report, because it was such a useful term. In my book, I use the term authoritarian economic statecraft. And it's, you know, kind of a little bit, if you will, as a subset of sharp power, because I'm talking about something very specific, anything that has to do with the economy. It was definitely a process for me of understanding that this was actually a quite innovative way that the Chinese government was using its increasingly targeted levers of control over its own economy for geopolitical purposes.
I know that at the beginning, you were saying that a lot of the conversations started out thinking about this as really a censorship issue, that China was focused on censorship. But the one example in the book that just really stood out to me is one that does involve censorship in a lot of ways. It's the example that is a story that you broke about Zoom and about Zoom censoring the ability of people to be able to speak there. Can you talk a little bit about that story? Because I think it really highlights the meaning and really puts it in context about what we're talking about here.
Yeah. So Zoom is a platform we're using right now. I've done a lot of my book talks on Zoom, ironically. You know, it's an American company founded in 2011 by a naturalized American citizen originally born in China. It's different from, say, Google Meet or WebEx, because it had a lot of employees in China. So almost its entire R&D team was based in China, more than 700 employees. But that aside, in 2019, the Chinese government blocked Zoom from the Chinese market. So Zoom also was operating as a consumer platform in China. China blocked it. And the block we knew, but what was not public at the time, was that the Chinese authorities demanded that Zoom come up with a rectification plan so that it would be more compliant with China's demands for real-time surveillance, handing over data to Chinese intelligence and security agencies, and real-time censorship, so the ability to shut down meetings in real time, but only in the Chinese market. These demands were made only in the Chinese market. And Zoom complied. And as part of that agreement, Zoom agreed to designate one of its China-based employees as the official liaison for the Ministry of State Security and the Ministry of Public Security, which are China's intelligence and security agencies. What happened, though, over the next 6 months was that, well, the pandemic happened. And so Zoom went from 10 million daily users to 300 million daily users. This was an amazing windfall for Zoom. Also an amazing windfall for China's intelligence agencies, because now they maybe perhaps had access to meetings that were happening all around the world. And so what we saw from Zoom's security agency liaison, his name is Julian Jean, was that he began to go beyond the official remit of his job and to spy on and collect information on meetings and users outside of the Chinese market. He found ways to get that information and hand it over to Chinese intelligence, despite Zoom having some protections, a porous firewall between its China-based employees and the rest of its employees. And this kind of came to a head in May and June of 2020, when there were, for the first time ever, Tiananmen memorials being hosted virtually on Zoom. And this employee was able to shut down some of those meetings and get some of those user accounts suspended. And it's actually quite funny, a little bit funny to me how he did some of this. So for one of the meetings that he was able to shut down, what he did was he fabricated evidence that there were accounts in the meeting that broke Zoom user guidelines. And then he created a bunch of like fake email accounts and emailed these complaints to Zoom. But what was so interesting was the accounts that he made, some of them were ISIS, some of them were Basque separatists, some of them were porn accounts, some of them were gambling accounts, and they were all in these like Chinese pro-democracy meetings together, which is hilarious. I mean, why in the world would there be like Basque separatists, ISIS, and porn accounts, you know, in a pro-democracy meeting? And so, you know, if Zoom had done even just the tiniest bit of due diligence, they would have realized that there was something wrong here, because clearly, you know, a meeting with those accounts doesn't make any narrative sense. It was just tailored to break Zoom's user guidelines. In any case, those meetings were shut down. And that's when the people who were running those meetings came to me and said, hey, our account has been suspended and one of our meetings was shut down. And I think it's really important to note here that, you know, these are longtime U.S. residents, some of them U.S. citizens. It was a paid account paid for with a U.S. credit card. The meetings were being held in the U.S. on U.S. servers by a U.S. company. And even so, the Chinese government was able to go in and shut those meetings down. Now, this is not just censorship. It's several things here. It's shutting down freedom of assembly. It's surveillance. It's transnational repression. I think I would characterize this as transnational repression rather than censorship. And it was also traditional sort of espionage-based transnational repression, you know, using China's intelligence services to track people abroad. And this was all made possible because Zoom needed access to the Chinese market. So why did Zoom have 700 employees in China anyway? This is something that they disclosed in some of their filings to the U.S. government, because it was cheaper. They were able to save money on operating costs. And it's so interesting because in its late 2019 public disclosures, Zoom said they acknowledged that it was actually a risk. It was a reputational risk, an operating risk, and a political risk to have these employees in China. But they said, we decided to keep them there because this was good for our bottom line. And then they also, there was that hook of access to the Chinese market. So this is an excellent example of this authoritarian economic statecraft that China uses to project power into reaches far beyond its borders.
Well, I think it's a great example, too, of how China takes advantage of American companies, because it wasn't just Zoom trying to get access to the Chinese market. It was the fact that Zoom's American and European customers wanted to be able to communicate with other companies or business representatives in China. So that if China cut off Zoom to the Chinese market, it was going to affect its American market. It was going to affect its European market. It was going to affect its international exposure, because it wasn't going to be able to connect its customers to people who were in China that they needed to be able to have communications with. I mean, this really kind of deals exactly with the problems that you're talking about in terms of China being able to set its policies in a way that takes advantage of the limited power of each individual American company, because America doesn't stand up and protect the companies as a whole. China is actually working against each individual company separately.
That's exactly right. And one of the big points I make in my book, and actually one of the reasons I wrote my book, is because I want to reframe the discussion that we're having about companies. I mean, yes, I don't love it when, you know, U.S. companies choose to self-censor to please the Chinese government. And I think it's fine to name and shame them. However, that's not going to fix the problem. It's just not. The Chinese market is too big. But more importantly, we have incentivized companies to behave this way. What have we told companies for 40 years? Just follow the laws and everything else is fair game. In fact, what you need to do, your number one job, your only job, is to make money. That's your only job. You know, as Milton Friedman wrote in his really influential essay, The Social Responsibility of Companies is to increase profits for its shareholders. But what happened was, and what, you know, Milton Friedman, I think, couldn't look forward into the future and understand that this was going to happen. An authoritarian foreign government has gained significant influence and sway over those profits. You know, so what would Milton Friedman have said in that case? The social responsibility of companies is to increase profits, but we acknowledge that by doing so, they have to obey the authoritarian demands of a foreign government. I think maybe that would have caused him to reframe some of his ideas. In any case, what companies need is more support from the U.S. government. But what I really mean by this isn't that the U.S. takes mercantilist stands, but rather creates laws and regulations to regulate what U.S. companies can do. Because that's what we've told them. That's the promise we've given to companies. Just follow the law and everything else is fair game. So what we should do is not rely on CEOs to be morally superior than everybody else. That's not reasonable. We change the laws to reorient the market back towards something that is more democratic. And so in the case of Zoom, what would that look like? If we're not just expecting Zoom to be on a moral high ground and lose, you know, millions of dollars because, you know, they feel that they should, or they feel that that would be the morally correct thing to do. I make some recommendations in my book. One of them is that the U.S. should require any U.S. company to publicly disclose if they have an official liaison with a Chinese intelligence or security agency. They should publicly disclose the name of that employee, their remit, so what they are required to do. And they should also disclose the specific offices that they liaise with. So in Julian Jean's case, it would have been the Hangzhou branch of the Ministry of State Security and the Ministry of Public Security, and sometimes also the Shanghai offices, to disclose that. And also, you know, to disclose what the demands are. This isn't controlling the U.S. company, it's supporting the U.S. company. What do I mean by that? When you have the Chinese government versus one U.S. company, you know, this is the world's largest and most powerful authoritarian government versus one company. Who's going to win every single time? Well, of course, the Chinese government's going to win. When you have a regulation from the U.S. government saying, U.S. company, you must do this, the U.S. company can go into the Chinese government, whatever demand they're making, and say, hey, look, you know, we would love to comply, but unfortunately, we have this law. And so if the Chinese government has a problem with that, they have to go to Washington. You know, they have to talk to the U.S. government. This raises the contest here. It's a government-to-government contest, no longer a company-to-government contest. And that is a contest of equals.
It also removes the possibility that one of their competitors will have lower standards.
Yes.
Yeah, because if Zoom would have been the one to have the moral high ground, they could have bankrupted their company simply if another company stepped in and said, we'll work with China, we'll do whatever they ask us to do, so long as we can be able to have access to the market. And then they would have been in a better position to be able to work with American companies that needed to work in China and so on and so on. And so, again, if the United States is setting up standards for all American companies to be able to live by, it's going to make everything onto a more even playing field for all the different companies.
Exactly. That's exactly it. I mean, you just said it. Another pressure that companies face is the sense of competition. Well, if we don't comply and we get shut out, our competitors will just take over and will fail as a company. It's too much pressure. It's not reasonable to assume that companies can make this kind of morally righteous decision. It's not fair.
So in a lot of ways, the United States has been kind of a laggard in terms of catching up to some of these policies. Australia was light years ahead of us. Why was Australia so far ahead of most democracies in changing its policies and its attitude towards China?
That's a very interesting question. You know, what some people said in response to that question was that Australia was targeted more heavily by the Chinese government, but that's not true. The U.S. has been among the top targets of China's economic and political pressure, its covert political influence operations, its industrial espionage. The U.S. has also been equally a target starting at the same time, which you can trace that back to the early 90s. The difference in Australia, I think there's a few reasons. One of them is that Australia is very close to China. It's a smaller country. It has deeper links, deeper economic links. And, you know, it's not the economic juggernaut that the U.S. is. And so, you know, it doesn't have as much power vis-a-vis the Chinese economy or China overall. And so the pressure it was feeling felt more severe. But I think some of it is also a little bit just chance. There are a couple of investigative journalists who chose, you know, starting like in 2008 to start reporting on China's covert political pressure in Australia. And one of those is John Garneau, and I feature him in one of my chapters. And it's just a little bit sort of chance, you know, that there was someone like him who had the background and the language skills and had the editorial support to be able to have these kinds of investigative articles. And Nick McKenzie is another really excellent Australian investigative journalist. And so in Australia, you know, you had a greater degree of transparency, is not the right word, but you had much more in the public domain for more years than the U.S. did. I mean, really, it wasn't until 2017 or 2018 that in the U.S. there was more reporting around this. But in Australia, that started in 2008. So there was just more knowledge. And then I think another sort of big factor was that John Garneau kind of pulled a Matt Pottinger, but before Matt Pottinger did, which is to say he transitioned from journalism to government. And he became Malcolm Turnbull's speechwriter and then ended up becoming an intelligence official tasked with writing this very influential intelligence report about China's covert political interference in Australia. So it kind of all ties together. You know, there are certainly lots of other academics and others in Australia who were paying attention to this long before they were in the U.S. So I would say it was that combination of factors. But what is so interesting, you know, is that I think much of the world, especially Europe, looked at the U.S. and looked at the Trump administration as leading this, you know, pivot to a tougher policy on China. And because Trump was so deeply unpopular in Europe and many of his policies were viewed as so illegitimate, the U.S. pivot on China was also viewed as like a Trump thing or a, you know, an illegitimate kind of racist fear-mongering thing. But what's ironic is that really the U.S. at this time was in part learning from the Australian experience.
One of the parts of the book that caught me off guard was that you don't paint Trump in quite as negative of a light as I'm used to be honest. Do you think that Trump made a positive contribution to how America reacts to China today? And I'm not asking for a wholesale endorsement, but do you think he made positive contributions in terms of shifting Americans' views about China?
I think my book presents the Trump administration's China policies in a pretty positive light. I don't know that I really spend that much time talking about Trump himself, except in the introduction where I talk about how his COVID policies were so harmful to the U.S.
Yes, I'm only talking about the China policies. It's a book about China. But I'll be honest, in the New York Times, you know, when Trump was pursuing all these policies and pursuing the trade war and everything else, I mean, I felt that a lot of media was painting it in a very negative light at the time. And so it was a little bit of a shock when Joe Biden came into office and many of those policies not only didn't go away, but in a lot of ways, Biden has doubled down on those policies.
Yes. So for those of us who were very knowledgeable in this space of basically bad things the Chinese government was doing beyond its borders, you know, ways it was coercing other countries in a way that is harmful to democratic norms and principles. For those of us who are really well-versed in the research that had gone into this, the reports that have been written in think tanks, the experts, the scholars, it was a relatively small community in the U.S., and we were familiar with each other's work. These were well-respected scholars. What we saw when the Trump administration began, you know, acting on this, was that we knew and we could see that, you know, if you followed the individuals who, you know, were very influential or instrumental within the Trump administration of implementing these policies, we knew where they were getting their information. And it was from this body of respected research. You know, for people like me who were situated in Washington, D.C. for the entirety of the Trump administration, it was a challenging time because, you know, how do you report on policies that are actually based in fact when so many other policies in the Trump administration were actually indeed harmful? It was a very challenging time to be a journalist and to report on that. But it was so evident, you know, from an early time in the Biden campaign, I knew the people who Biden tapped when he was running, who were his national security advisors during his campaign, who were going to be the people who were going to be his China advisors if he won. I knew them personally. And they had been some of the people when they were, you know, not in government, who had written some of this research that the Trump administration was using to make policies out of. So when you see those people getting tapped for future positions, you know, it's obvious which direction the Biden administration is going to go. And so for those of us with this kind of inside look, it was, you know, not a surprise at all that the Biden administration chose to continue these policies. But I think for people without being plugged in that way, it was because of the way this was painted. And that was especially true in Europe, especially true in Europe. Now, I don't think that the Trump administration got everything right on China, particularly when it comes to the way that Chinese citizens living in the U.S. were treated, or Chinese nationals or people of who were, you know, originally born in China, the way that visas were blocked, the way that ethnic Chinese researchers and scholars were targeted for their research, sometimes at U.S. universities, the way that this was put onto Chinese people themselves and some of the inflammatory and racist rhetoric that was used was really harmful and obviously was not based on good research. But many of the other policies, especially 2020. So if you look, there's an internal list of all the public actions that the White House took. Just in 2020 alone, it was more than 200 China-related actions. I was very busy writing all that stuff up. What was so fascinating was that what Trump did as a person was he gave permission to people like Matt Pottinger and others to do things differently, to not be so constrained by the thinking of the past 30 years, whether in terms of engagement with China, we have to engage, we have to engage, you have to engage, they'll eventually become like us. And also in terms of neoliberal policies. And this is something that I speak about in my book a lot, this idea that the government can't do that. This isn't something the government can do, right? We can't get involved in trade. And Trump didn't care about that. You know, he was like super not neoliberal. That didn't bother him. And so he empowered people to kind of break things, to try new things. And I do think that the Trump administration was very innovative in trying new things. And actually, going back to Zoom, after I, you know, broke the story about this, the Department of Justice launched an investigation into what had happened at Zoom. And up to that point, when I had spoken with people who had been targeted on U.S. soil in this kind of a way before, because that was not new, or when I, you know, spoke to just people in the government, the thinking was, oh man, it's super unfortunate when the Chinese government pressures U.S. companies to censor in this way, or it's super unfortunate when, you know, you feel you're being under this kind of pressure, but it's not illegal. There's nothing we can do about it. There's no mechanism that we can use to use the arm of government or the arm of law enforcement to go up to try to change this behavior or to, you know, say that it's illegal. And so 6 months after this investigation was launched, they issued a public indictment, a 40-page detailed public indictment and an arrest warrant for Julian Jean. And the two charges against Julian Jean were actually very innovative. It was the first time that these charges had been used in this way. And one of them was conspiracy to transfer personal information across borders. And I can't remember what the other one was, but they had never been used in this way. And the Department of Justice, the FBI special agent who was in charge of this, Joseph Hochdahl, it was clear that he had worked really hard to find ways that behavior that happened in China channels back to U.S. soil to say, well, this broke this U.S. law and this broke this U.S. law. So that was the kind of attitude we saw throughout the Trump administration, trying new things. And the Biden administration has not been innovative in that way. But I don't think that they necessarily need to, because it's always great for government to be innovative. But I think a lot of the framework was there. And so they could extend these policies, you know, the growing use of the Commerce Department entities list, for example, more sanctions, this kind of thing. They could extend and codify what the Trump administration has done. And what the Biden administration has done that is so valuable is kind of repair our relationships with our allies, try to bring them along, because, you know, we all know what Trump was like as president, and he would bully our closest allies and really damage those relationships. And the Biden administration has worked really hard to repair them and to work in a multilateral way to get away from the idea that this was just like the crazy U.S. pulling another Iraq, that this was actually a multilateral thing that many democracies view as important. The Biden administration has done a lot of good work with that. And they also have been innovative to some extent. For several years now, there has been discussion of the need for an outbound CFIUS, so outbound investment screening. The White House issued that executive order a few months ago. It was not huge in scope. It was a kind of small scale, but the first attempt at outbound investment screening. Very interesting new idea and new mechanism.
The impression that I kind of get from you, and I definitely got this in the book, was that it wasn't so much Trump himself. I mean, it was the people that Trump surrounded him with within the context of the U.S.-China policy. Because in a lot of ways, Trump kind of was the weak link with the way that he kind of disrupted things with allies and some of the things that he did. But the fact that he put certain people in there that then allowed things to open up, like you talked about with the Department of Justice and other things. I did not realize that that was really happening. And that really caught me off guard, because the narrative coming from Trump himself did not give me the impression that that was happening either.
You're exactly right about that. And for anyone who's interested in learning about the factional struggles in the first year of the Trump administration, I really recommend Josh Rogan's book, Chaos Under Heaven. He talks about that. You know, in the first year after Trump took office, his administration did basically nothing on China. They had no China policy. They did nothing. And then a year later, they launched the trade war, which was kind of a different thing. The trade war was about the economy. It wasn't about geopolitics. Now, Trump was acting on real problems. The launch of the trade war was, I think, the initial shock that kind of broke things and, you know, made future policies seem more possible and more realistic. But it was a bit different. And the people who were involved in the trade war, the actual people in the administration, were different than the people who became more involved in the real geopolitical struggle a couple of years later. What we see in the Trump administration over those 4 years is a gradual growing assertiveness, or hawkishness, if you will, that gradually expanded across more and more sectors. The interesting thing is that to the extent this happened, except for the trade war, it was mostly Trump just not caring. He would give people a green light. Oh, just go do whatever you want. It's fine. I don't care. So what about when he didn't do that? So up until the beginning of the pandemic, Trump still hoped to get more concessions from China on trade. And I think it was January 2020 that the phase one trade deal was signed. And he hoped for a phase two. He hoped for more. And because of that, he was not willing to let some of his administration officials, particularly, for example, on the National Security Council or in human rights offices, take some of the actions that they wanted. But the pandemic really changed. It didn't change Trump's mind, I think, so much as just frustrated him. He stopped viewing Xi Jinping as a buddy, you know, that he could maybe massage and get what he wanted from, as viewing him and viewing China as a real bad guy, as a real adversary. And he stopped caring about trying to curry favor or trying to get concessions. But the function basically was him just opening the floodgates, just saying, fine, you do whatever you want. I will sign it. It is fine. And that's why in 2020, there was this dramatic increase in the number of White House actions on China, because everybody could just do what they wanted. They knew they were pretty much going to get a green light. And so it was just people frantically just like, this is on my wish list, and this and this and this and this and this. And the best example of that is, I think it was taken the very last day of the Trump administration, when the Trump administration designated what had happened in Xinjiang as a genocide. That was something that Trump personally doesn't care about at all. We know for a fact that Trump did not care about Xinjiang and was happy for Xi Jinping to do whatever he wanted there. Trump actually blocked and delayed actions on the genocide in Xinjiang because he was hoping for these trade concessions. But he eventually just lifted the floodgates, let everything through. And that is a little bit more of his role in it.
In terms of China itself, like just to think about it from a big picture aspect, I mean, you're describing it in terms of weaponizing its economy. I mean, that's subtitled the book. Is China's behavior inevitable for such a powerful authoritarian country? I mean, is this something that was going to eventually happen as it continued to increase its power? Or is this something that you think of as a deliberate choice that they didn't really have to make?
I don't think anything really is inevitable. I would say it's a choice. And when it comes to the use of, you know, economic statecraft in this sense, it's been a bit like this famous Deng Xiaoping saying, 摸着石头过河, feeling the stones as you go across the river. So figuring it out as you go. And we see the earliest examples of this, of China's weaponization of its economy for illiberal purposes, quite a long time ago. 26 years ago is the first big example I know of with Hollywood. Everyone knows this example these days. In 1987, there were two movies about Tibet that came out presenting Tibetans as victims of Chinese military occupation and colonialism. That really rubbed the CCP the wrong way. And they barred the two studios that had made those movies from the Chinese market. That was like an earthquake across Hollywood. It really shocked the industry. And it has been one of the most successful examples of economic coercion because in the past 26 years to this day, there has not been one major Hollywood production that has gone against a major Chinese Communist Party red line. Not one. 26 years of silence on that. And what's especially astonishing about that is that in 1997, the Chinese economy was like one-tenth the size of the U.S. It was not huge, not the way it is now. But even more shocking is that the Chinese box office was like negligible in 1997. There was not money to be made in 1997. Rather, it was the promise of future wealth that drove these companies. They didn't actually earn anything by being silent, not in the beginning. It was like, in the future, we'll make money. It was this idea, this perception that they would eventually become rich by having access to the Chinese box office, which is now, just recently, just in the past few years, has become the world's largest box office. It took more than two decades. I think that that was a very early success for the Chinese government. And we see them over the past 26 years further honing their ability to do this and the ways by which they do it. The foundation for China's extension of its power beyond its borders through its economy is the way it does this domestically. You know, what are the mechanisms by which it does this? And the foundation of it is what some scholars are now calling party state capitalism. And this is the way that the Chinese government exerts selective political control over economic behavior inside of China for political reasons, not for purely economic reasons. It's different. What we're talking about here is different than a communist-style centrally planned economy. This is not the five-year plan dictating how many widgets each factory in Zhejiang province needs to produce in the next 5 years. That's not what it is. You know, there is an element of market economics. There's an element of market capitalism where companies make their own decisions. But what we've seen is across the board, the Chinese Communist Party has found ways to build levers of control over even very small individual private company decisions to be used at selective crucial moments. And some of these mechanisms are having a communist party cell embedded in private companies, even up to the level of the board, so that there's that kind of direct connection, explicitly making United Front work about private enterprise behavior. And other mechanisms like this. And certainly the way that the Chinese government cracked down on Jack Ma and the tech industry as a show of power. That's how this works abroad, too. So if there's an Australian company or a US company or a Korean company that does something politically wrong in Beijing's eyes, they can lean on their private companies to shut off this behavior, even without issuing a formal sanction of any kind. What we have seen in the past few years, really since the pandemic, is China's growing adoption of more formal sanction-like measures, including their anti-foreign sanctions law, which theoretically punishes companies for complying with foreign sanctions. It's sort of a direct pushback against sanctions. And it's a list, it's an actual list. They've also rolled out actual sanctions. And so, for example, there are now Chinese government sanctions against some members of the European Parliament, against think tanks in the US and in Europe and in the UK, formal financial kind of asset related sanctions. What we're seeing, I think, right now with innovations in the Trump administration and the Biden administration, now we're talking about economic innovations for the point of political purposes in China. What I think we may see in the future is a kind of economic arms race where both sides are trying to create ever sharper and more innovative economic tools to try to control and shape the behavior of the other side. And with that, a gradual pulling of these two poles into something like porous economic blocks or economic spheres of influence.
Closer to what we had in the Cold War between the United States and Russia, although it's difficult to imagine that it can actually get to that point, the way that supply chains are interconnected, the way that the world is globalized. The thing that strikes me about the movie industry with Hollywood and it being affected by China is the fact that that's one of the creative industries. I mean, that is one of the industries that's supposed to be expressing different forms of speech. And really, any type of entertainment industry kind of falls into that bucket. I mean, even sports kind of falls into that bucket with different stars like Serena Williams and LeBron James able to use their social media platforms to make political statements at times that can really change people's opinions and change people's minds. And the NBA is, again, another great example of being controlled by China, because when Daryl Morey puts out his tweet for standing up for the people in Hong Kong, I mean, the most innocent possible way of expressing support, China hit back against the NBA, and the NBA pretty much more or less caved in response. So I guess my concern here is, if these different industries that are based around speech and based around expression are able to be shaped by China so much, how can any American company really do business with China and for us not to be concerned about those different links?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is a place, again, where the neoliberal water in which we swim is not sufficient. The idea is that up to this point has been, well, this is something for civil society. Governments can't get involved here. We have to have hashtag campaigns. We have to have consumer boycotts. That doesn't work. It clearly doesn't work. That hasn't worked against Hollywood. That hasn't worked against the NBA. It hasn't worked against Tesla, you know, opening a showroom in Urumqi in Xinjiang. It doesn't work. To go back to this idea is that companies need support. And they need to be able to interact with the Chinese market knowing that the U.S. government and all of its institutions and power are behind them. What does that look like? Because what can we not do in democracies? You know, we talk some about how in the contest between authoritarianism and democracy, it's sometimes an asymmetric contest because democracies cannot and should not adopt all the tools that authoritarian governments can. So the U.S. government cannot pass a law telling companies that they must criticize the genocide in Xinjiang. No, we can't do that, and we don't want to do that. So what should we do? What can we do? There's a number of things that we can do. First of all, is to have a mechanism, make it explicit, that anytime a company is punished in the Chinese market for free speech, whether that's the company's own speech or speech of its employees acting in their own private capacity, if they are punished in the Chinese market, that there is a mechanism and a fund for emergency assistance and relief from the U.S. government. So in that kind of case, the NBA is estimated to have lost, you know, $200 million in the Chinese market. If there was an emergency relief fund from the U.S. government that was, you know, ready and available for companies to kind of make claims on, look, this is happening to us in the Chinese market, and they know that they can get some emergency assistance, that helps blunt the power of China's control over its market. And it's even better in a multilateral sense or an international sense on a government level. When a country or a government is under pressure from China for authoritarian reasons. So Lithuania, for example, when it decided to improve its unofficial ties with Taiwan or Australia in 2020 when the Prime Minister Scott Morrison called for an independent inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus. And both of these countries faced these wide, you know, sweeping sanctions and tariffs from China. If there had been some kind of multilateral mechanism, an emergency relief fund on an international level to send targeted aid to these industries, not only would it help those industries in the short term, it would also be a kind of deterrence for this kind of power, this kind of pressure from the Chinese government to know that it may not have the psychological power, the fear that it does in the minds of, you know, CEOs and governments everywhere around the world. That's one example. Another is if the US government sanctioned several of the top Chinese companies that are most complicit in creating the architecture of censorship inside of China. So if there was a sanction against these companies for implementing Chinese government censorship, so sanctioning Baidu, sanctioning Tencent, this would do a number of things. But most importantly, for our purposes, it would create a halo of deterrence around implementing Chinese government censorship. And it would certainly discourage or make it impossible for U.S. companies to partner with these major companies. But it would also create a halo of deterrence around partnering with any Chinese company that censors. And part of what we're looking for here is that deterrence, you know, because the Chinese government doesn't go around censoring or, you know, blocking all companies for all speech all the time. It kills the chicken to scare the monkey, makes example. If we can have our own kind of example to push back against that, that can help sort of right this market distortion. I do want to make a point also that while we've talked a lot about shaping the behavior of companies, China's authoritarian economic statecraft and economic coercion also is directly targeted at shaping government behavior. And I'll give a really good example of this. There was a report from Reuters last week about how in 2016, the South Korean government said it was going to install a U.S.-made missile defense system known as THAAD. And this was to increase its overall defense capabilities against North Korea. But Beijing didn't like it because, in theory, this missile defense system could also be used against China. So as a result, there was these sweeping economic sanctions from China against various sectors of the South Korean economy. So including, K-pop stars who were blocked from performing in China, and K-pop music blocked from being streamed on Chinese streaming sites, and Chinese tourists were no longer allowed into South Korea, and the South Korean retail chain Lotte suddenly faced a lot of problems in the Chinese market. So really extensive, but informal and opaque sanctions. Last year, there was a South Korean marine technology company that had made an agreement with Taiwan to help provide some of the parts and technology for Taiwan's own indigenous submarine project to help Taiwan build its own indigenous submarines for the first time. South Korean authorities arrested the executive director of the South Korean company and fined the company for what it said was endangering South Korean national security. And in the affidavit for this South Korean man's arrest, the authorities made explicit mention to the controversy around THAAD in 2016. They explicitly said, we are afraid of economic retaliation because of this behavior, like what happened in 2016. Basically, this kind of economic coercion caused South Korean authorities to arrest one of their own citizens for totally legitimate trade behavior that is probably, at the end of the day, in South Korea's long-term national interest. South Korea, you know, supports Taiwan, you know, informally as a democracy. And certainly it's in, you know, U.S. interest and Japanese interest for Taiwan to be able to defend itself. So actually you see South Korea being incentivized to act against its own national interest and defense interest to avoid economic coercion from China. Just the fear of economic coercion from China.
So we've talked a lot about China's ability to be able to weaponize its economy, and you've kind of painted a picture of ways that the United States could be able to fight back. Do you feel that if the United States did implement these policies to be able to fight back, that it would be able to put these policies into place in a way that would have a stronger impact on China than China has had on us and other countries? Like, do you think that the United States has a stronger hand economically in terms of economic statecraft?
I love that question. Let me tell you why. For many years now, people believe that it's not possible people have essentially given up on the idea that the U.S. government or democratic governments can do anything to stop the Chinese government from censoring inside of the Chinese market. We've given up on that. All we ever talk about is when the Chinese government basically is able to censor outside of the Chinese market. We say that, oh, it's not possible, it's not possible, it's not possible. But what's so extraordinary about that is the Chinese government has demonstrated that it is possible. We're living that right now. It is absolutely possible for a government to use economic pressure to change the speech, behavior, and actions of actors beyond its borders. Beijing has proved that to us. Thank you, Beijing. Of course, it's still possible to change some of the risk calculus inside of China that Chinese companies are making. We just haven't tried. So I mentioned sanctioning Chinese companies for implementing Chinese government censorship. Now, that is not going to stop Beijing from, you know, having a very, very tough hand of censorship. But what it is going to do is for the first time force Chinese companies to have a risk and benefit analysis of certain kinds of behavior, because up to this point, Tencent has faced zero repercussions for obeying Chinese censorship laws. None. There's never been any attempt. And that risk calculus would then travel up to Beijing. We talk about how, you know, U.S. companies and U.S. corporate interests have formed an informal pro-Beijing lobby in Washington, D.C. and in capitals all around the world. We haven't, I think, done a good enough job of trying to do the inverse of that, using Chinese companies to lobby Beijing in the other direction to the extent that they are able to do that. What if, you know, major Chinese companies came to the Chinese government and said, look, you're making these censorship demands on us. You know, of course, we'll obey them if you make them, but we want you to know that it will hurt our bottom lines to do so. That kind of risk and benefit analysis is what we want. Even if all they're doing is thinking about that, that is the first step of deterrence.
Well, Bethany, thank you so much for joining me today. Let me plug the book one more time. It's called Beijing Rules: How China Weaponized Its Economy to Confront the World. Thank you so much for talking to me about this topic, and thank you so much for writing the book.
Thank you so much for this really very nuanced and in-depth conversation. I appreciate it.
If you are listening to the show, please leave a review. It really does help shows like mine stand out. Also, please share the show with colleagues and friends, because word of mouth goes a very long way. Facebook and Twitter are great, but really just talk about it. There's a full transcript at www.democracyparadox.com. Thank you for listening.
The Democracy Paradox podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute has a 40-year history of excellence in advancing research and education on global democracy and human development. Learn more about the Kellogg Institute, including its world-renowned visiting fellowships for scholars at various stages of their careers, at kellogg.nd.edu.